Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, commuters with your computers. It's Tom Dark, not Stab here, aka the host of Monkey Tennis. Before we start this week's podcast, just a quick plug for the upcoming live show. In very exciting news, we are exceedingly pleased to tell you that due to phenomenal demand, the live show has had an upgrade. So on November 22nd, you will now find us in the large room at London's Prince Charles Cinema. To remind you, we'll be talking all things Know Me, Knowing Y'all, and even more excitingly, chatting to Simon Greenall, otherwise known as Michael the Geordie. So if you're coming and you have any Michael-specific questions, do send them our way. If you aren't yet coming, don't delay, get your tickets today. They're available at postpoppodcast.com/monkeytennislive, but we recommend you do be quick as we've already outsold last year's live show. Anyway, that's enough from me. On with the podcast. Cue the Black Beauty theme tune.
Monkey Tennis?
Smelly Alan Fartridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Hello again, pod fans, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. As you should know by now, we're trawling our way slowly but surely through iPartridge. We need to talk about Alan. By the end of today's show, a man will be dead, a marriage will be over, a cracker will have been pulled. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
A glass of beer and a piece of toast on Christmas morn.
Nick Older.
A bear-like homosexual.
And Tom Stab.
But Forbes McAllister is also a victim in a way because, of course, he died.
So, chapter 13, liftoff show-wise.
Good morning, Pear Tree.
We're obviously using Alan's mandatory playlist as well to suggest songs you might like to listen to as we tackle each chapter, but there is not one for liftoff show-wise.
Oh, well, that's a shame.
Imagine your own incidental music.
Yep, we'll leave that up to you. So we kind of start in Pear Tree Productions with this chapter, and we get a mention of Jill.
Lovely Jill.
I love Alan's description of her here. Clinging on to the last of her good looks and happy to buy choc treats for us all every Friday. That's the important bit there. Alan goes on to describe his management style, saying it was that of an estranged father, at times caring, at times distant, and with little to no interest in the individuals under my charge. And believe me, it just works. So obviously at this point in Alan's book and the career, Knowing Me, Knowing You is on our television screens. But as it turns out, viewing figures are collapsing, to use Alan words.
Well, hang on, though. It doesn't stop him saying the show began and was an unmitigated success. Viewing figures collapsed as this series went on. We discussed this bit when we were talking Knowing Me, Knowing You, didn't we?
Yeah. So he says the viewing figures were collapsing because it was getting lighter in the evenings and more people were out rambling or sitting in beer gardens. Yep. As we have discussed, and as we know, this series was on air in September and October, so that is absolute bullshit.
He does recognise, though, that there were one or two hiccups, but that is the nature of live television, and that some of the guests were a little surly.
He says, I honestly don't think people noticed.
He also
I think they did.
He says it came down to the booker, and at the end of the series, Jason was duly dismissed, worth noting that the other booker, Lisa, had already been fired.
yeah, and also, like, that. Well, that booker was probably supposed to still be at school, anyway.
Yeah. And was high on weed.
And he implies that Jason went on to be responsible for Big Brother.
That's a nice little dig at reality TV there, isn't it? I just love the one or two hiccups, and it's like, well, basically all of the guests were either surly, aggressive, generally awfully behaved, racist, take your pick. Everything was an absolute disaster.
Worth noting as well that Alan thought Tony Hez was only going to be a temporary fixture because he was there to cover Georgia Harris's maternity leave.
Oh, yeah.
That's the first time we know that he's just covering for someone, isn't it? Beforehand, we've always assumed that he is.
Think it's a device that allows Alan to, the way that Alan treats Tony and changes his mind and has to sort of butter him up and not care about him.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and speaking of Tony Hez, towards the end of this chapter, Alan talks about the feedback that he was getting from the Chief Commissioner, which as follows. Tony Hez gave us a few notes after the first show and repeated the same ones after the second, third and fourth, but crucially didn't after the fifth or sixth, which suggests he was deeply satisfied with the trajectory of the series. Again, this is the unreliable narrator coming into play and it's a fantastically comic payoff. But I did wonder, what would those notes from Tony Hez actually be apart from, this is awful?
Stop it. I think perhaps that somebody, maybe not Alan, did take some notes on board, and that's why the fifth episode was live from Paris with the co-presenter. Yeah. It was sort of an attempt to keep the magazine format, but maybe sideline Alan a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was also thinking about this, that obviously by this point, the show's a disaster. Surely Tony Hez is as much to blame as Alan because Tony commissioned it. So he must have been trying to save his own back.
I guess on paper you see, a rising star with his own chat show, you know, speaking to popular guests. On paper, it wasn't that bad a show.
Where does responsibility lie?
Well, I think you just don't commission a.
We do not know.
Don't commission a second series.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you've got to imagine that in the Alan universe, Tony Hez would be kicking himself that they'd agreed to six episodes and a Christmas special because you know that he didn't want that Christmas special to happen.
A monstrous disaster.
So that's all I had for Chapter 13, Liftoff, show-wise.
It's quite short, to be fair. It's one of the shorter ones.
Yeah. So we can move on to Chapter 14, a pivotal chapter in iPartridge, the death of Forbes McAllister.
Which Alan would like you to coincide with listening to Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits.
Tugging on those heartstrings.
A fitting tribute.
So the chapter opens with cantankerous bon viveur Forbes McAllister had brought with him two of Lord Byron's duelling pistols, purchased and auctioned from under the considerable nose of Michael Winner. As I politely expected them mid-interview, I discharged one and the bullet penetrated and destroyed Forbes's heart. As so many gunshot wounds to the heart, it proved fatal.
Now, it's quite funny they mention Michael Winner because presumably Forbes McAllister is based directly on Michael Winner, and this is a little nod to let you know that's intentional.
Yeah, I think we talked about this, that it's a bit of a hybrid of Peter Ustinov and Michael Winner.
That's right.
Yeah. Not much further on in the chapter, Alan says, I wouldn't have been the first British chat show host to kill a man on air, and I won't be the last.
He will be the last.
Yeah.
What I like about this is that Alan kind of tries to relieve some of the blame from his shoulders by saying that
almost
basically
all of it.
Well, yeah, by basically saying
the whole chapter he spends the whole chapter putting in hints of Forbes's poor health to try and absolve his guilt.
So the line I was going to read was that Forbes McAllister had led a long and full life, but with a diet rich in cholesterol and alcoholic booze, it's very probable that his health was failing.
He also comments that Forbes had incredibly sweaty hands, and I think goes on to
describe it as palm piss.
Yeah.
Oh, he then blames that sweat for potentially creating a lethal lubricative effect, which when combined with studio lights and a hair trigger pistol would blast a man's chest into kingdom come.
But those are Alan's findings, not the findings of the coroner or the crown.
Yep.
he kind of talks more broadly about the show and suggests that it had been a strong one, although acknowledges it had been a little bit fruity, and of the six people on the sofa, 50% were gay, two lesbians and a gay man.
And should we talk about who the other guests in this episode were, Nick? Because I think it's one of your favourites coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the undeniable talent of Joe Beasley and Cheeky Monkey.
So, I like the way you gave it like a little intro. Cheeky Monkey!
He's here tonight. So, yeah, Alan teases us up with, not on the sofa, but undeniably on the show, were Joe Beasley and Cheeky Monkey. Having Joe appear on the show was my one big regret in this episode. So he regrets that booking of a poor puppeteer more than killing a man.
Yep. It should have been so good. Joe was streets ahead of his time, writing his own material and bringing a fresh perspective to the art of stand-up comedy. But we all know the reality of something very, very different.
It was absolute car crash TV, also, and one of our favourite parts of that whole
series.
Doubt,
yeah. Without a doubt.
Interesting that Alan discovered Joe Beasley in Ho Seasons in 1979, and then later he says, I promised I'd remember his name and give him a TV break as soon as I could. I honoured that promise in 1994.
That's great.
Well, at Ho Seasons, it says that he raised the roof and that members of the audience were literally doubled over, desperately trying not to wet themselves. That's how good Joe Beasley can be. So to be fair to Alan, he was expecting high things.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Joe and Cheeky just couldn't deliver.
Joe Beasley says that might actually be more to do with the fact of the age of the people watching the show rather than how funny it is.
It's incontinence,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Alan does say that he happens to believe Joe Beasley's joke about a Swedish Fred Flintstone is quite a beautiful piece of writing. But he struggled to remember its precise mechanics and it slithered out of his mouth like a bad oyster.
Can we take a step back? Am I the only person who doesn't know what Ho Seasons is?
Yes.
Well, I know what it is.
I assumed it was some kind of Butlins.
Is it like a Butlins
thing?
Yeah, type thing?
Like
okay.
A Haven Butlins caravan based.
Does it still exist?
I think it might. Oh, I don't know. In certain regions.
Literally never heard of it.
I love that Joe basically tries to trade on this by trying to claim legal ownership of the phrase troubled TV funny man.
When the whole Barrymore thing blew up.
Yeah, yeah.
So after the time spent discussing Joe Beasley and his questionable comic talent, we then move into Alan killing Forbes live on TV. Like he says, the two lesbians, Wanda Harvey and Bridie McMahon, went a bit hysterical. They'd been told to stick around on the sofa until the credits rolled, but when Forbes's remains slumped in their general direction, they bolted. And he says, a pretty craven attempt to spoil the series sign-off. For that, I've never forgiven them. He's really not grasping the severity of the situation here, is he?
Yeah.
We asked the question, who was the guy who appears after Alan shoots Forbes? We have an answer. It's Alan's producer, Rupert Summers.
Yep, and I love this bit. He says, he lost his head and said a few mean things to me. I let that go. He was in shock and needed help. And I've listed these. He calls Alan a tosser, a tit, and a wanker. Mm-hmm. Also, something I've just remembered, which we never did at the time. I've got a slow-mo video of the shooting incident.
Yes.
And you can see the gun is very much not pointing in the right direction to actually hit Forbes. So we will finally post that on the socials this week because we forgot to do it last time.
We forgot.
Hello.
Other things that Alan has concern over, other than Forbes being shot, the fact that he bleeds on the sofas that they'd only just hired.
Forbes.
And he says, those flipping guns, I hated them just then.
Only then.
He blames Forbes for bringing it in when they're only supposed to be displayed ornamentally.
Yep.
And he uses this shooting to make the claim that he invented reality TV.
It was I, Partridge.
This was reality TV before the term was invented. Real and raw and red in tooth and claw. Peter Bazalgette of Endemol fame is sometimes wrongly credited with the invention of reality TV. In fact, it was Alan Partridge. And then he goes on to detail being imprisoned, which is
We kind of referenced this in the episode of No Me Knowing You, because we weren't 100% sure how he actually kind of
got away with it. Yeah.
This is effectively the beginning of Alan's slide to his lowest ebb, isn't it? It starts at this point and it ends in Dundee.
I think you're bang on the money there. Yeah.
I don't think it ever ends, does it?
No, that's true. He has something of a recovery post Dundee, but I think this is where, you know, there's this. Obviously, not to spoil anything coming up, but the next chapter is called Splitting from Carol.
Things are not. We're on the slide now. We're on the descent.
Yeah.
I was just going to jump forward slightly that in a later chapter, to give a conclusion to the shooting incident, Alan says that he was deemed guilty of unlicensed use of a firearm, and that was the only crime he was guilty of.
Mm-hmm.
So not murder or manslaughter or anything.
He's got good lawyers.
So that's how he got away with it. So yeah, Alan is incarcerated for an entire for 2 days, the 21st to the 22nd of October 1994, at Paddington Green Police Station. And in the photo section of the book, he refers to Paddington Green Police Station as the UK's highest security police station. Do we think that's true?
No, no, no,
that's true.
No, no, that's true.
Is it?
Yeah.
What?
That's how do you know that?
That's where all the terrorists go.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's true.
Oh. Wow, absolute fact bomb.
I mean, we're not going to check it.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if it is. I don't know if it's the highest. It is definitely.
We look forward to the next feedback episode.
Yeah. It's definitely high.
Okay.
Okay, so for added drama, Alan slips into the present tense to talk us through his incarceration. And you get some great exchanges with a police officer. I've told you what I know. Can I please just go home? I'm doing a store opening at 10 for World of Leather. The only thing you'll be in tomorrow is a world of trouble, says the copper. A line that even at the time I thought was pretty good for someone who probably didn't get any A-levels.
Speaking as a man who barely got two.
He got two.
Yeah.
And he just always assumes that he's above everyone else.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a store opening. He was just saying it to get
out. It was just a lie. This is followed with, he says, with negotiations for a second series of KMKY going well, I have two other meetings the next morning that could shape my career. So I was like, is that a lie that he doesn't really have those meetings, or does he generally have no sense of how screwed his career is at this point? It's quite hard to tell whether it's...
Yeah.
Even if the meetings were genuine, the meetings are going to be cancelled.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
even if they're genuine, it's over.
But yeah,
that hasn't even entered his thought, though, has
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. And then Alan gets some prison food, which I think is worth going through.
It gives a good review of his
prison. Yeah. Let's go.
Through a hatch comes a tray of food. I pour at it listlessly until I notice that it contains chicken nuggets. And what chicken nuggets? These boast all the smoky zing of McCain's southern coating with the tenderest cuts of white meat.
Doesn't that mean they're just McCain's southern chicken nuggets?
That's absolutely what that means.
Yep.
The beans are lukewarm but not overcooked, and a generous dollop of smash adds a buttery finish. It sets the plate off beautifully. To drink, a mug of steaming tea. A really, really good meal.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I read that back, I was just like, quite fancy,
yeah,
actually.
That's
absolutely quite good.
Oven cuisine,
yeah,
actually quite
that,
good.
That's tonight's dinner sorted.
Yep.
So yeah, Alan is finally released after those, basically those 2 days and one night of incarceration for questioning. And yeah, he's hauled into the BBC for crisis talks without a care for his other meetings, which I think we've established are probably fictional.
Yep.
He says, Hares is quiet and it's really hard to work out how he feels the series is gone.
He's not giving anything away.
Yeah, I think we know what he thinks. He continues, a health and safety officer has a lot to say, which feels like bolting the stable door after the horse has legged it and in a hail of gunfire.
I love his mangling of like well-known phrases.
Yeah.
He uses bolted too early in the sentence and then he can't use it at the end. It's great.
And then he refers to the Gwyneth Paltrow film as the sliding doors.
No one's fact-checked any of this.
HarperCollins.
I love that he says, as the exec producer, it turns out I have ultimate responsibility, which seems unfair to me, and I say so. Then goes on.
I love this next bit.
I tried to arrange a meeting with Hares to discuss not just a second series, but other potential projects. And this is the killer. Everyone pipes up with, for fuck's sake, Alan, as if my career should die just because Forbes's has. So, yeah, basically, at this point, the BBC are disowning Alan. So calls to the BBC are met with an officious, Alan Partridge is not and has never been an employee at the BBC. He's a private contractor. And as such, all contracts are under constant review.
And then there's a classic payoff to the chapter here. You know, there were two victims that day. Me, because of everything I went through. But Forbes McAllister is also a victim in a way. Because, of course, he died.
No description of what Alan went through. It's just, you know, what I went through.
Yeah, getting a lovely meal of chicken nuggets.
Absolutely,
basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think Alan feels that his TV career, his burgeoning TV career being under question is more of an issue than someone being dead.
He sees himself as a victim in this.
Absolutely, oh, yeah.
And it's about to get worse as we move to chapter 15, Splitting from Carol.
Sorry, Adam, what's
splitting?
On the well. Adam, what's on the soundtrack?
There's only one song that Alan feels is appropriate for this level of heartbreak. It's Alone by Heart.
Yeah, so this chapter opens with Alan saying that he knew that basically him and Carol were on the rocks back in 1989, but then he goes on to say they lasted another 6 years.
Yep.
So I did think at this point, do we actually feel a little bit sorry for Alan? Yes, he's a bit of an idiot, but he's been in basically a failing relationship for a good 6 years.
I mean, I initially...
It's a comedy goldmine, don't get me wrong.
Reading it from Alan's perspective, I feel quite sorry for Alan. But then when I really think about it, the person I feel sorry for is Carol. Because she's had years of this shit.
She didn't have to marry him.
No, that's true. But the overriding theme of this chapter is very much that the writing's on the wall and Alan is refusing to see it, isn't he?
Yeah, so we then get a lot of excerpts of Alan's diary during this time because he's suspicious of Carol, but is trying to work out what's going on. And the diary entries are hilarious because he's basically told nearly every other day exactly what's going on, but doesn't form the conclusion. Yeah.
Is it because he doesn't want to, or is it because he's stupid? I think it's a bit of both, isn't it?
I would think a bit of both, probably. Yeah. So suddenly, things that had seemed innocent, the snazzy new hairdo, the packet of condoms in her glove box, reported sightings of her in nightclubs with a man, started to collect in my crawl. So even that's not enough yet. At this point, Alan just wants to... Form some investigations.
And also, like, there's an entry in Carol's... an entry in the diary where he says that Carol is 40% less randy. He can't just say, like, you know, her feelings seem to have waned. It's very specific. It's very measured. He can't just... He can't articulate it in a kind of a normal way.
Another thing, do you also think that maybe he secretly kind of likes the role of detective a little bit? And he's actually quite enjoying
it.
Well, it gives him something to do because his career's on the rocks, I guess. But I think it's the fifth or sixth diary entry in. He literally writes, 6th of September, 1995. Carol's brother turns up and tells me she's seeing another man. I reluctantly discredit his testimony on the grounds that he's a former alcoholic and current weed junkie.
Very important postscript to that as well. He tells me she's seeing another man, and then the footnote says, he says banging, actually, but I mean, honestly. from the point that the diary starts to the point that he realises and gives up, it's 4 months as well.
And the writing is very much on the wall from about week two.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the final entry reads, decided to stop keeping a diary now. I'm not an idiot.
Yeah, and that's where I felt a little bit sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's Christmas.
And also he is an idiot. Yeah.
So about halfway through this infidelity diary, he starts wondering, is it a Noel Edmonds gotcha prank? He says, actually, what if this is a gotcha? Edmonds could be one sick bastard. And I do have the profile to be the subject of a BBC One Saturday night prank.
Does he?
No. I think he does.
Really?
Yeah. If you think about it, he's just come off a primetime BBC Two chat
show. But there's no way that the BBC want him back on their screens.
That's true.
Apart from the contractually agreed
true.
Christmas special.
But I do think he has the requisite level of fame to feature as a Noel Edmonds gotcha.
Yeah, maybe.
Another couple of quick highlights here. 1st of December 1995, heard Carol on the phone saying, that was great sex last night. Oh, this is so confusing.
Oh, I love his explanation, his justification how he justifies of that. He basically, he thinks maybe she says sects in reference to a pseudo-religious teen version of step aerobics. Maybe it was someone's name, Jim Great Sex. Perhaps she was trying to say great six in a Scottish accent. Come sunrise, I'd convince myself of all these things.
And on the 15th of December, 1995, he gets drunk and tries it on with Sue Cook.
Yeah, which is never referenced before or after, is it, at all?
She was so understanding.
Yeah.
Good old Sue. Yeah, although she is witheringly emphatic in her rebuttal. Yes. She's not having it, Alan. No,
good old Sue.
Less than a week later, he's out with his other showbiz pal, Bill Oddie, using basically bird-watching techniques to spy on Carol.
Quite a good use of Bill Oddie's talents, actually.
Yeah, very useful, man. I love the face-off they have in the kitchen where Alan sat at the kitchen table with a bottle of wine, but he hadn't drunk from it or opened it.
Yeah. He also kind of, I'm not going to read this out, but he talks about French kissing and feels the need to explain what French kissing is.
Oh, it's a bit too much, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just like, there is no need for that, Alan. Come on.
It's so scientific, the way he's describing. Yeah. Just a couple of choice words. Closed arena, intermittent insertions, exploratory recces, prods, darts, scoops and jabs. Just some of the terms involved in Alan's definition.
Yeah, exactly the bits we just avoided reading out. It's disgusting.
I said I won't read it out.
You've read it out. And when Alan and Carol have the kind of face-off at the crescendo of this chapter, he writes, I didn't know on whose behalf I was crying because I was making a right mess. I had a cold at the same time, so it was like a mucal tsunami. Which, again, is a really lovely image, isn't it? So towards the end of this bust-up, I think Alan knows it's on the rocks, it's falling apart, and so he begins frantically pitching shows at her, desperately outlining my portfolio of program ideas in the hope of convincing her we could be happy and rich. Although I think we know That's not going to happen.
He really does.
He links one with the other.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because it basically means that in Alan's eyes, she's not with him because he's a kind or interesting person. Mm. She's with him because he's got the potential to make money doing bad telly programs.
And do you reckon they're exactly the same TV programs that you pitched to Tony Hares?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
Why would Carol care? Monkey tennis?
Yeah, so being honest, by this point, it's all fallen apart. It's gone tits up. It's basically over between Alan and Carol. The next large section of the chapter is essentially a faked letter from Carol. When I say faked, let's use Alan's description. So what follows, Alan says, these are Carol's actual words in the sense that I ghost jotted them and faxed them to her I don't know how many times for her to sign off. She had ample opportunity to make amendments, but declined to do so. Ergo, she's happy with it. So it's quite a long letter. So maybe we just pull out a few particular highlights because it's very clearly written by Alan, not by Carol.
One of the key bits that make it clear that it's Alan, he says, I then split with Alan, who hadn't been having an affair. Not because he couldn't, he could. He was a well-regarded TV personality. You think he was short of offers? Dream on. But he exercised self-restraint. What can I say? That's Al. I think that might be the first ever instance of anyone referring to him as Al as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I would kind of just add that he is damn sight more of a talent than the likes of Tony Robinson or Andy Marr. Again, like, there's no way Carol's going to be writing that. These are the people that Alan holds in high regard.
And also, would Carol call Andrew Marr Andy Marr? I think that's quite unlikely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a particular line that I liked in this. After every unreturned phone call to the BBC, he'd dig an angry hole in the garden. So I really enjoy that in this fake letter, he's unwittingly exposed some quite bizarre activity that the reader wouldn't know about otherwise.
He's losing it. Yeah. It's almost like in Sizzle Dial when he's having a fake argument with the man who he gave a fishing rod to.
Yeah, there's definitely some psychoanalysis to be had here, isn't there? He's not in a good place.
A fun bit at the end when he demands sole custody of the children. Fernando wasn't keen as he's living in Cambridge midway through the final year of a politics degree.
So he's at least 2021.
Yeah. And Denise is living in Ipswich with an art collective, which I think shines a little bit of a light on why he sees Denise in a lesser light than Fernando.
And she's got a pierced navel, remember?
Good point. His lawyers advise him not to pursue it. As he says, the law always takes the side of the woman. Cool, so that's all the notes I've got on that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're ready to move on, it's time for chapter 16, You'll Be Sorry.
To which the accompanying track in Alan's playlist is Stop the Cavalry by Jonah Louie.
And that does feature prominently in this chapter. So, in this chapter, we join Alan home alone on Christmas Day because him
like
and Carol are no longer.
Bloody Culkin.
Yep. it's only a few days since him and Carol have split coming into Christmas. Alan says the prospect of spending Christmas in unbroken solitude didn't fill him with cheer, but actually it turned out to be all right. Brilliant, even. I've subsequently done the same, out of choice, on 4 other occasions. So there are some specific reasons why Alan enjoys being free to do what he wants on Christmas Day. That year, he has a glass of beer at 10 a.m., a glass of beer and a piece of toast. And he says he didn't finish it. It was horrible. But I chortled as I thought of what the ball and chain would have said. Stupid cow.
I would also say there's no rule about boozing on Christmas morning. It's get involved, surely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would say anything before 11 a.m. is madness. Post 11, no, I think it's a free for all.
Champagne for breakfast.
I would say champagne. Oh, no, that's what I mean. I'm having it at about 11.
I'd normally have a later breakfast.
Yeah, champagne exactly. Or Bucks Fizz before 11. Yeah. After 11, anything goes. Crack the spirits out by lunchtime.
Yeah. Alan goes on to write about the almost overwhelming sense of liberation that comes with wearing a dressing gown, brackets, nude beneath,
always nude.
without having to anxiously re-knot the string every few minutes. The gown flops open and reveals your ghoulies. Big deal. No one's there. It just feels good.
Does everyone else do the same?
No, although I do agree with him about dressing gowns constantly needing re-knotting for those knots to fall apart.
That is an issue. But
I don't really wear a dressing gown.
You're not a dressing gown man?
No. I like the idea of them, but I just don't wear them.
Oh, okay.
So what you're saying is you hate dressing gowns?
Just saying I wear pyjamas.
Okay. No, what he's saying is can we all chip in and buy him a dressing gown?
Yes, please.
No, we can't.
John Lewis.
Always.
So what we're learning about Alan here is his first Christmas Day alone post-Carol. He's basically getting boozed up at 10 a.m, prancing around naked underneath a bar of dressing gown. So he writes, after a few more glasses of beer, he put on a CD of Christmas songs and marched up and down on his landing to Stop the Cavalry by Jonah Louie.
Is that the one that's like...
Yep. That's the one. Very good rendition. Nice. And then, of course, after a few minutes of brisk promenading, his gown spread apart like the curtain of an old proscenium arch theatre to reveal a one-man show by John Thomas.
Would not buy a ticket.
He says, I let it. And then, there were other reasons why Christmas Alone was enjoyable too, but I can't remember them at this moment. Question, were there actually any other good moments on that day?
No.
I think he probably boozed himself into a stupor and just cried for the rest of the day.
Yep.
No, he didn't. He had a TV show to make.
That's very true. He had Knowing Me, Knowing Yule to work on. As he terms it, he'd been given a chance of redemption. I don't think so.
He was contractually
obliged. In the following line, it had been agreed as part of the initial series commission.
Although, as we know, the BBC are kind of slack with their contract arrangements after what happened with Chris Feather. They managed to get out of that contract, so I don't see how they couldn't have got out of this one.
There must have been a buyout clause, surely.
It's not referenced.
I don't know.
It's not referenced.
But yeah, well, I mean, it does say, because the inquiry was still ongoing, he's yet to be deemed culpable of anything.
Right.
So perhaps if they had, then it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
So yeah, Carol left him on Christmas Eve 1995. Knowing Me, Knowing You will be broadcast 5 days later. Alan says it was conceived as a kind of televised mulled wine and mince pies party that would take place in an exact studio mock-up of his house.
And you could imagine that as a concept working all right.
Yeah, had it not
been for Alan, like the set looked decent, you know, it was laid out as if people were enjoying themselves, although they were doing that sort of Jules Holland shuffling thing of
forced enjoyment.
Yeah, not really being enjoying themselves, not being allowed to actually move around, but.
And we know that it's a faithful replica, as we talked about a few weeks back now. You've got the fan of samurai swords on the mantelpiece above the fireplace, etc. So has anyone seen any real life TV Christmas specials that reminded them of this show at all? Particularly with their kind of Full House mock-up.
Well, yeah, they feel like something from yesteryear. You don't really get them anymore. They're not as relevant anymore.
I mean, the House mock-up is nothing more than a rehashing of Noel's House Party, is it really? Like,
but in terms of actual TV specials as well, I think you can run the gamut from like a Bing Crosby Christmas special to a Michael Bublé Christmas special, that kind of having the Full House mock-up.
People ringing the doorbell and
all that. Yeah, all that sort of thing. I think it's done quite a lot. So.
The Queen's Speech, or do you reckon that's actually Buckingham Palace? Studio mock-up.
Mock-up of a...
Does that count as a Christmas special?
No, it's
does it once a year.
Yeah.
Obviously the show is another absolute disaster. Yep. It was never going to be anything but. Mm-hmm. Alan says they had some last-minute gremlins, including things as having an 11th-hour panic sourcing of wheelchair ramps.
Four brackets, check, aplegic, former golfer, Gordon Aaron.
Check, aplegic.
I'd spotted that first time, that's very good.
That kind of ties in when we were talking about the lax attitude to quality control with anything that comes out of Pear Tree Productions, the fact the book has all these notes in to check things that it's gone to print with those still
Alan
in there.
And Pear Tree just rushing it out. There will obviously be a blow-by-blow account of Knowing Me, Knowing You at our live show as well. We're going to be talking about that on stage at the Prince Charles Cinema in London on November the 22nd. You can get tickets at postpoppodcast.com/monkey. Yeah,
very unlike Adam to mention that. I didn't have that information.
At least for once, I waited for it to be context-specific.
Yeah, it's fine to mention it.
So I guess we'll go into it in more detail then. So in terms of like the specifics, there's only a couple of things.
There's a little mention from Alan about a sexy trio of models called the Christmas Crackers and Mick Hucknall, and Alan says Hucknall agreed to perform because he was trying to bang one of them. Now the real reason behind Hucknall appearing in the show, he was genuinely a fan of Partridge and wanted to get involved.
He probably did still want to bang one of them.
that's a given. I thought that wasn't worth referencing. Just to go back to the disastrous nature of the show, to another bit of beautiful phrasing from Alan. And yes, there were a few glitches, but most of them occurred in the final 4 minutes of the show. He continues, one thing led to another. I ended up punching a golfing cripple in the face after he'd made an off-colour joke at my expense, and then responding to Tony Hare's have-a-go intervention by belting him a couple of times too. But the rest of the show was nothing like that. But I think we can agree there were several disasters throughout the show from start to finish. Yeah, there's a lot more to go into.
A little tidbit about the aftermath of his split from Carol. He does also mention that between Christmas Eve and the show, he'd had 4 hours sleep in total.
So Alan kind of tries to justify in the book his violent behaviour towards a few people on the show. He says, I was like a wounded animal. If you stepped to me, you'd better brace your ass for genuine smackdown. They stepped, I smacked down. I couldn't face going home. So after unwinding with a few halves of bitter, I spent the night with Glenn Ponder. The next day, I felt much happier. Now, we should return to him spending the night with Glenn Ponder via a footnote later on in a different episode.
Yes, good note.
Alan also goes on to mention that Tony Hayes was angry that he was invited on the show to be ambushed into recommissioning Know Me Knowing You. Alan says, nothing could be further from my mind. He was also angry that I'd punched him in the face. He was probably equally angry about both, yeah. I would think. And the last note I had about this, just with a footnote, lies. Alan says, it wasn't a big deal, to be honest, because I'd already started thinking about that. I didn't want to be on BBC TV anymore, so it was fine. The opposite is very much true.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of You'll Be Sorry and to Tom Dark's section of I Partridge. Thank you very much for your factoids. But there's a quiz to come, right?
There is a quiz to come and a large question to the group. What would you like to do first, gentlemen?
Quiz?
Quiz it is.
Quiz, then question.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, who is ready for a quiz?
Always.
Deeply.
Well, that's good news because we're going to do one. So, this week's quiz, soundtracked by the theme to Supermarket Sweep.
Yes.
Because why not? is Partridge versus Edmonds. So, obviously, Alan was suspicious he might be the victim of a Noel Edmonds gotcha in splitting up with Carol. So, we thought, it's time to do an Edmonds-based quiz.
As play along at home as well.
Yeah, as a child contestant on a Noel Edmonds game show, I'm hopeful that I will nail this.
Can we post that appearance on our socials?
Absolutely not.
Okay, we'll get it on the socials.
Yeah.
Right, okay, so all you have to do, listen to these quotes, and I want a group consensus answer whether this is Alan Partridge or Noel Edmonds that said it.
Okay.
Correct answer gets one of these.
Should try that again?
Try that again. Correct answer gets one of these.
There we go.
Okay. Question one. Graveyards are so depressing, they remind me of death.
That's Alan.
That's Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's 1 point correct. Question two. All of this wine nonsense. You got all these wine people, don't you? Wine this, wine that. Ooh, that's a snazzy bouquet. I don't really need to go on, do we?
No, it's AP.
It's Alan. Three. I could have gone over to him and quite legitimately thumped him, actually, because I'm quite a good thump.
I think that's Edmonds.
But yeah, it's
mainly because it's not Partridge.
Yeah, I don't recognise it.
You're going Edmonds?
Yeah, Edmonds.
It's Edmonds.
Yeah. Boom.
He was talking about A.A. Gill. Oh. Information. Question four. Let me tell you something about the Titanic. People forget that on the Titanic's maiden voyage, there were over 1,000 miles of uneventful, very pleasurable cruising before it hit the iceberg.
Alan.
AP.
It's AP. This isn't very difficult so far, is it? Question five. The biggest problem we have is not Ebola. It's not AIDS. It's electro-smog.
That's got to be Edmonds.
Yeah, I'm going with Edmonds.
It's Edmonds. Six. I got her a 5-ton rock.
What? That? What?
Edmonds.
I got her a 5-ton rock.
Edmonds. I think that's Edmonds.
Yeah.
Can I just say I'm thinking about releasing a spoken word record called Electro Smog?
Would not buy. Question seven.
Edmonds would.
Question seven. He is a total wazzock and I cannot stand him.
Ooh.
Oh, this is one of them talking about the other, isn't it? I think it's Alan on Edmonds.
Ooh.
When is it? I don't know when Alan says
I don't recognise the quote.
Gotta push you for
the
group
answer.
I think
it's a quote from Nomad and I think it's Alan on Edmonds.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go with him.
If you're confident,
let's
do it.
Adam.
I'm semi-confident.
You are bang right.
Yes.
Yeah, it's him on Edmonds in Nomad.
Nice.
Number eight. I don't like big feet. It reminds me of Gammon.
AP.
AP.
It's AP. Number nine. People tell me I don't look 66.
Edmonds.
You've got Edmonds. You are correct.
Yes. This is the last one.
He was 30 at the time.
Number 10. We're having a hoedown. I'm down, but I'm not a hoe.
AP.
That's AP.
It's AP. Number 11. These idiot politicians who talk about climate change, for goodness sake. Do they really think little us can do anything about it? No, of course not.
I assume Edmonds. I think Edmonds. Unless it's from Nomad.
This has been
the
trickiest.
Yeah, I don't recognise an AP quote.
I do not know the answer. So
I do,
what
not,
are you going
do not know. Should we go Edmonds?
Let's go Edmonds.
Okay. Yep. Group consent. It's Edmonds.
It's Edmonds.
She's had a beer.
12. You don't live life, life lives you. There isn't such a thing as death, it's just departure. You cannot die. It's been known for a very long time.
That sounds like Edmund's mystic bollocks to me.
Yep, let's go Edmund's.
We're going Edmund's. You are correct.
Yay. Is this the last one?
13, there's two more left.
Two more.
13, I looked up and it got better and better. I got to her face and I immediately thought, oh yes, I like you.
I mean, it's Alan-esque, but I don't recognise it.
No, again, I don't recognise it. So
I think it could be Edmonds.
I'd go Edmonds.
Okay. We're going Edmonds?
Edmonds.
Yeah. You're correct.
Yeah. Come on, this one for a full house.
Yeah, number 14.
Come on.
Guide dogs for the blind. It's cruel, really, isn't it? Getting a dog to lead a man around all day. Not fair on either of them.
Alan Gordon.
Alan. Full house.
That's yes, a full house. 14
good
out of 14.
Good work, guys. Good work.
Getting better.
Wasn't that difficult, I don't think. But anyway, more fun coming up now with a new regular feature. It's time for Large Question of the Week. So, over the last couple of weeks, we have discussed luminary British sporting and broadcasting legends. Sally Gunnell, Chris Akabusi, Des Lynam, and Dale Winton. Nearly forgot about Dale.
Motherfuckers act like they forgot about Dale.
So my large question to you is, it's the bank holiday weekend, what are you doing and which one of those four is with you? Adam, go.
It's Akabusi whispering a wooger in my ear and patting me on the fanny.
Oh, Christ.
Oh, that is horrible.
Oh, Stab, we need to move on quick. What you got?
I thought about this and I went actually quite practical. I try and use Dale Winton's supermarket connections and I'd get him to take me round Waitrose and I'd get some kind of like trolley dash going on and I'd fill up as much as I possibly could from Waitrose.
You are aware Supermarket Sweep wasn't in a real supermarket.
Look, he's got the connections, all right? Dale, I need you to help me out here.
Fine.
Take me around Waitrose. I want as much free shit as I can get.
Fair enough. Nick, what are you going for?
I am going to take Sally Gunnell on a date where we're going to go to Chicken Shop, not Nando's, i.e. no need for a Nez. We're going to get pissed and then I'm going to chuck a dustbin through a car.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. Yeah, I'd probably go for Des Lynam and myself. Lovely Sunday afternoon out, maybe go for a roast and then go on the boating lake in Battersea Park, something like that.
Sounds lovely.
Lovely
stuff.
Fantastic.
Well, that brings us to the end of this section of iPartridge. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. Hopefully you realise that, otherwise you've wasted an hour.
Also, I hope that you've been listening to these without reading or listening to the book before, because if so, we have ruined it for you.
For God's sake. Join us next week when we're moving on to Tom Stab's era of iPartridge.
Oh, yeah.
And Alan's return to Norwich, plus the Linton Travel Tavern that we know and love so dearly. Get in touch with us. You can email us thepartridgepod@gmail.com. We're on Twitter @thepartridgepod, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, and on Instagram @monkeytennispod. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, thanks again and goodbye.
Goodbye.
See ya.
Monkey Tennis? Smelly Alan Partridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.